Welcome back, history buffs, curious minds, and their alike, in our series working through the history of the Christian Church, telling the story and lives of the Church through 2,000 years of Christian thought by some who are regarded as Christianity's greatest thinkers and church leaders. Today we have another, well, I hope, riveting chronicle of one of Christianity's most intriguing early figures, Cyprian, the Bishop of Carthage. Get ready today as we uncover spiritual struggles, dramatic twists, and the important impact this influential man and leader has in the story of the early Christian Church in our latest episode of A History of the Christian Church, telling it through the lives and the thoughts of some of its most influential thinkers down through time. Drop in with me today as we journey through the life and legacy of Cyprian, a journey that I hope will leave you intrigued, inspired, and maybe, perhaps even a little bit confused. Let's dive in. Let me first begin with a biography of this man's life. As an overview, Cyprian was a bishop of Carthage and an early Christian writer of Berber descent. The Berbers are a distinct ethnic grouping of indigenous peoples of North Africa, those who predated the later arrival of the Arabs. He was born at the beginning of the 3rd century in modern-day what we would call Africa, perhaps at Carthage, where, based there, he received a classical education. A controversial figure during his lifetime, yet his strong pastoral skills and firm lead during what was called the Novatianist heresy, and indeed his eventual martyrdom at Carthage, established his reputation in church history and proved his faithfulness, you might say, in the eyes of many in the church ever since. But how does that view stand up for us today? Well, let's begin with looking firstly at his early life in a little more detail. As I said, he was born into a rich pagan upper class family in a Roman state, but African, North African, Carthaginian family, sometime during the early 3rd century. Before his actual conversion to Christianity, he was a leading member of the local legal fraternity, based in Carthage. He was a fairly well-known local orator, and he was employed many times as a pleader, a sort of advocate in the Roman courts of that time. The skill that he displayed there meant that he was asked to teach rhetoric at Carthage and was probably destined, because of his abilities, for high public office. Some suggested he might have maybe been offered a position of even of provincial governor. However, in 245 or 246, he turned his back on his career prospects by converting to Christianity. He tells us himself how he was attracted to Christianity, and it lay in his search for moral renewal. Cyprian actually describes his own conversion for us and his baptism in the following words from his book Ad Donateum, chapters 3 and 4. "When I was still lying in the darkness," he wrote, "on a dark and gloomy night, I used to regard it as extremely difficult and demanding to do what God's mercy was suggesting to me. I was held in bonds by innumerable errors of my previous life, from which I did not believe I could possibly be delivered. So I was disposed to acquiesce in my clinging vices and to indulge my sins. But after that, with the help of the water of new birth, the stain of my former life was washed away, and a light from above, serene and pure, was infused into my reconciled heart. A second birth restored me to a new man. Then, in a wondrous manner, every doubt began to fade. I clearly understood that what had first lived within me, enslaved by the vices of the flesh, was earthly, and that was now instead the Holy Spirit had wrought within me was divine and heavenly." Amazing that that was written, what, 1800 years ago. Anyway, following this, Cyprian was indeed baptized at the age of about 35 years old, we believed. And after his baptism, he in fact gave a large portion of his wealth away to the poor of Carthage as a signal to point to his new status as a Christian. It was not long after his baptism he was in fact ordained as a deacon and then soon afterwards as a priest. And sometime between July 248 and April 249, he was elected Bishop of Carthage, a popular choice among the poor people of that region who had remembered his earlier patronage and saw it as demonstrating what they hoped would be a compassionate style of local church leadership. However, his rapid rise to such a position did not meet approval with some of the other senior members of the clergy in and around Carthage, and opposition never completely disappeared during his time there as bishop. However, not long afterwards, the entire Christian community worldwide was to be put to an unwarranted test. A persecution was coming. Christians in North Africa had not suffered persecution for many, many years, and some would say they saw this impending trial as a result of the sin not only of themselves, but also of the complacency and sin in the mainland European church. In 250 AD, the Decian persecution began. This was initiated when the Emperor Decius issued an edict ordering sacrifices to be made to the gods throughout the whole Roman Empire. Jews were specifically exempted from that requirement, but interestingly, Christians weren't. Cyprian chose to go into hiding rather than face potential execution. Now, some clergy saw that decision as a sign of cowardice. However, Cyprian defended himself by saying that he had fled in order the faithful would not be left without a shepherd during this time of persecution. Therefore, by doing so, he would be able to continue to lead them, although from a distance and in hiding. And he argued that that response was in fact in accordance with the divine will of God. Moreover, he pointed to the action of the apostles and what Jesus himself taught in Matthew's account in the Olivet Discourse about the response on what should be our response when persecution comes. Writing on this in his tract De Laptis, For the Fallen, he said this, Therefore the Lord commanded us in the persecution to depart and to flee, and both taught that this should be done, and himself did it. For as the crown of leadership is given by the condescension of God and cannot be received unless the hour comes for accepting it, whoever abiding in Christ departs for a while does not deny his faith, but waits for the time. Now these years that followed were years of intense turmoil for the church. Cyprian found his qualities of leadership tested to the utmost during this time. His thoughts and his writings through this time were a response to the problems that the wider church faced. He was first and foremost a man of action. He wasn't just an intellectual. With Cyprian, life and thought could not be separated. It was impossible to describe one without the other. He was also, it's fair to say, greatly influenced by his predecessor, Tertullian, whom he was said to have read every day and actually referred to him as the master. But while Tertullian was a radical, some might say a nonconformist and a born outsider, Cyprian was above all a practical man of affairs, if you might say a natural born community leader. With Cyprian, Tertullian's perhaps more extreme ideas about moral discipline are tempered and made more realistic and in effect outworked in submission to a form of ecclesiastical discipline and church discipline, a hierarchy of discipline, if you like, that he initiated and recommended. But Cyprian, as I said, faced problems from the very moment he was appointed bishop. Some of those senior clergy at Carthage were jealous of this, as they say, upper class upstart, who they felt had been appointed bishop in effect over their heads. Now, these tensions might not have proved too serious had the church not faced this most complete persecution that it had ever faced up to this point so far. The Decian persecution was in fact the first coordinated empire-wide persecution of the Christian church. The Emperor Decian, in doing it, made a two-pronged attack on the church. First, the leading bishops were to be liquidated. The bishops of Rome, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Caesarea were all martyred. Cyprian, as I said, warned in advance, actually fell into hiding and lived in the countryside near, but not in, Carthage. From there, he directed the church during the persecution by these letters and treaties that he wrote. But as I said, he continued to face harsh criticism for his decision to flee, especially from those remaining clergy who still survived. During this persecution, all Christians were commanded to sacrifice to the gods, and all were required on pain of death to obtain a certificate stating they had done this. Those certificates are still available and were documented by Eusebius, the church historian, who we'll look at next time.
Hi, this is Ashley T. Lee Podcast. Join me to hear the Bible read line by line and clearly explained. Listen to the Word of God in your car or home or work while it transforms your mind daily. Romans 12:2 says, "Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, which is good and acceptable and perfect." Knowing the Bible can give you peace and joy in this hectic world. Listen weekly to Ashley T. Lee Podcast on all podcast sites.
You see, the church at this time, or up to this time, had only known for years relative peace and calm, and in many ways were not prepared for this sort of attack. Large numbers of Christians did indeed offer and sacrifice to the Roman gods. One bishop even led his entire congregation to sacrifice in a religious service. However, many others evaded the order by simply bribing the officials to give them the necessary certificate without actually having to sacrifice. And then there were some who, of course, just willingly embraced it and made the sacrifice. Traditionally, those who had apostated, so to speak, and renounced their faith completely were not normally readmitted back into the church. But what was to be done with the large number of people who, under pressure, had signed their certificates or sought fake certificates? What should happen regarding their readmission? Because, of course, following the persecution, many did return seeking readmission. Well, Cyprian thought there were two separate issues going on here. Firstly, should the lapsed be admitted at once, or should they only be admitted after a time of public confession, followed by a period of penitence, or should they never be readmitted at all? And secondly, of course, on that actual decision, who should make that decision one way or the other? Some who were imprisoned for their faith and ready to die for it, and others had signed forms under pressure, and some others still had simply bribed an official to get a faked certificate. As different perspectives prevailed, some bishops and local church leaders simply took it upon themselves to make their own decision, and many did in fact reconcile the lapsed back into the church. Now, there was some previous warrant for this action. Many would say all previously had been required was a public declaration of penitence, but some local leaders and bishops were considered to be acting irresponsibly because they lavishly pardoned all and sundry, readmitting them into the fellowship. So the question, of course, became, where did authority lie? And where did the authority to do such things and make such decisions, did it lie with the local confessors and priests or with the bishops? Cyprian insisted that it in fact lay with the bishops. They were, of course, to take advice and, where possible, if they felt right, heed the recommendations of the local leadership. And Cyprian actually chose to write a very important work on addressing this question. Eventually, a council at Carthage in 251 decided that reconciliation was possible for the lapsed anyway after a period of penitence. Now, the following year, in the face of a possible renewed persecution, another council decided that those who had at least begun that period of penitence should be readmitted forthwith. It's fair to say that Cyprian took a leading role in both these councils and the decisions they made. However, these difficult decisions did not meet with universal approval. Some, even at Carthage, his hometown, thought that some were being too strict. Some of the clergy actually separated from the mainstream church, forming a rival congregation, and another group also split, forming another rival congregation, one that had much laxer discipline. In Rome, on the other hand, there was a split, or a schism as it was called, in another direction. A new bishop called Cornelius, who was appointed in 251, he favoured the reconciliation of the penitent, but Novatian, a very gifted presbyter, a lower positioned religious leader, one, it's fair to say, who may still have been angry at not having been chosen as bishop himself, set himself up as a rival bishop. His church would not admit any of those who had lapsed, unlike the wider church, the Church of the Apostates, as he called it. Cyprian, in response to all this confusion, issued a tract, De Laptis, on the fallen, and it was that that caused him to convene another council of North African bishops at Carthage again. Cyprian, as ever, tried to steer a middle course between those in favour of welcoming back all and sundry, with little or no penitence, and those who would not allow any of these lapses to be reconciled. The council's view in the main sided with Cyprian and condemned the extreme points of view. But the schism continued as the remaining lax group elected a man called Fortunius as bishop in direct opposition to Cyprian. At the same time, the rigorous party in Rome, who refused reconciliation of the lapse, they actually raised up Novatian as a bishop of Rome, in direct opposition to Pope Cornelius. These Novatianists, as they have come to become known, also secured the election of a certain Maximus as a rival bishop in Carthage as well, in direct opposition to Cyprian. So Cyprian now found himself wedged between the so-called lax and rigorists. But this polarisation highlighted his firm but moderate position, and Cyprian gradually, steadfastly strengthened his influence by over time wearing down the vast majority of his opponents from either side with his well-argued letters and tracts. Cyprian regarded the question of schism or division within the church with the utmost seriousness. His most important treatise, or one of them certainly, is titled The Unity of the Church. It's wholly devoted to this matter. He believed that the unity of the Church of Christ is a given fact, but he also held that there was no room for a variety of denominations. The only true church, he said, is the Catholic Church. It is not possible, he said, to divide the church only to leave it, just as a Novatian had done in his schism. The one who leaves the universal church, he believes, commits spiritual suicide. Writing in The Unity of the Church, he said this: if a branch is broken from a tree, it cannot bud. If a stream is cut off from the source, it dries up. Nor can he who forsakes the church of Christ attain to the rewards of Christ. He is a stranger. He is an enemy. Without the church for your mother, you cannot have God for your father. If it were possible to escape outside of the ark of Noah, then it may be possible to escape outside the church. But there is one baptism. The schematics think that they can baptize other ways and yet forsake the fountain of life. They promise the grace of living and saving water, but many are not washed and their foul sins are not purged, yet they pile up. That birth makes sons not for God, but for the devil. Do they fancy they have Christ with them when they've gathered together outside of his church? Suppose these men were to be killed by confessing Christ's name. The stain of the schism is not even washed away by the blood of their martyrdom. The unforgivable, grievous sin of discord is not even purged by their suffering. You cannot even be a martyr outside the church. So clearly, Cyprian believed in this unity of the church as he saw it, and he also believed that it should always be focused on the bishop, saying that the bishop is in the church and the church is in the bishop. If anyone is not with the bishop, he is not with the church. Bishops, he believed, are the successors of the apostles. i.e. he believed that they took over the function of the original apostles. The bishops, as he saw it, were supreme in the church, though yet he only remained a bishop as long as he was in solidarity with the other bishops of the Catholic Church. Thus, bishops are seen in the same way today as we might see shareholders in a company. The shareholders have a share in the company, but only in conjunction with the other shareholders. The bishops must remain in solidarity with one another, yet each is independent in his authority within his own church. Now, there's a tension here in Cyprian's thought, which was to be exposed in further questions and controversies that soon arose. The question immediately arose when it was asked if someone is converted to Christianity through the Novationist sects and later decides following that they want to identify the truth, the whole truth, as lying within the mainstream church, and they want to join that mainstream Catholic Church, did they need to be rebaptized? Rome said no. Cyprian, following traditional African practices, said yes. Stephen, Bishop of Rome, sought to impose his view on others, which would lead to another controversy. Cyprian maintained that each bishop could decide for themselves. There was to be no bishop of bishops, whether at Rome or the wider Catholic Church. Later, as we know, the Catholic Church would decide otherwise. For a time, though, there was effectively a breach of communication between Rome and Africa. Several Eastern bishops sided with Cyprian and rebuked Stephen for his arrogance in enforcing his view on others. However, the situation was overtaken again by a further wave of persecution coming. This common threat led all to close ranks across the Christian world. Africa and Rome tacitly agreed to go their own ways over the issue of what was called rebaptism, which in effect was a victory for Cyprian's position. But this later persecution was to be the last Cyprian would face. More on that later. Okay. Before moving on, let's consider and give a quick overview of his most important writings. Cyprian's work were edited together into a four-volume set, of which three and four remain today, called the Patrologia Latinia. Now, he was never a speculative theologian. His writings were always in some way related to pastoral ministry and the reality of Christian life and leadership in the church into the community. The first major work he produced was a monologue spoken to a friend, which he titled Ad Donateum, which was meant to detail his own conversation with Donatus, and in it he talks about the corruption of the Roman government and even about things like the evil gladiatorial spectacles, and pointing to prayer as the only true refuge of the Christian. Now, during his exile period from Carthage, Cyprian also wrote his famous treatise De Ecclesiae Unitae, in other words, on the unity of the Catholic Church. And on returning to Carthage, he issued his famous De Lapsus, his treatise on the fallen, which we mentioned earlier. Another important work of his was his treatise, his dissertation, if you like, on the Lord's Prayer. Now, today only part of his written work survive, only some 66 letters of hundreds still exist today. It's also worth noting that a deacon of his at Carthage also wrote a biography of Cyprian's life titled The Life and Passion of St. Christian, which details the information regarding his early life, his conversion, notable acts, and even his upcoming martyrdom under Valerian. In terms of his theology, it's worth noting several areas. First of all, in terms of his view on the sacraments, Cyprian believed in infant baptism and infant communion. Cyprian, however, spoke against the efficacy of baptism done by any heretics as he viewed them outside the church, and insisted on their rebaptism if returning to the church, and he believed that the Eucharist cannot be possibly consecrated by anyone or any church leader outside the church. Cyprian was one of the earliest of the church fathers to enunciate clearly and unambiguously the doctrine of what we would today call baptismal regeneration, the idea that salvation happened at and through water baptism, but only, of course, duly administered in the perspective in which he held it. While he attributed all the saving energy to the grace of God, he considered the immersing of saving water as the instrument of God that makes a person born again. In other words, receiving a new life and putting off what had previously been. This water of new birth animated the new believer to a new life by the Spirit of holiness working through it. Many modern Christians today would share much of that perspective, but the division would come as they would see that water baptism as representing that which has already happened, simply portraying it as a witness to the world that these events have indeed taken place in the heart and mind of the new believer. In terms of his view of the church itself, Cyprian believed that the lapsed could only be readmitted to church after penance. Cyprian also believed that the see, the bishopric of Peter, based in Rome, was in fact the direct heir of Peter. Now, while Cyprian believed that all the apostles were equal and that all the bishops following the apostles in their succession were in a sense equal as well, Cyprian still emphasized the unity of the church and it should exist under a single chair, as he called it. And that he, Jesus Christ, assigns a like power to all the apostles, yet he also, by nature, founded a single chair, a cathedra, as he called it, by which he established his own authority as a source and place and space, which was the intrinsic reason and positioning of unity within the Christian church. This primacy, as he described it, was given to Peter, whereby it was made clear that there is but one church and one chair. And so to all the apostles, yes, their shepherds and their flocks are shown to be as one and are fed by all the apostles in this single-minded accord. And that would still apply to the bishops to his day. Other theological positions that Cyprian was believed to have held is the fact that he was amillennial in his end-time theology, and he also argued that perseverance, even under persecution, was simply a gift of God. Cyprian also argued, by the way, that each day of Genesis consisted of 1,000 years. Okay, I've hinted at it earlier. We find events unfold under the persecution of someone called Valerian. In 256, a new persecution of the Christians broke out under the Emperor Valerian, who was based in Rome. In Africa, Cyprian decided to prepare his people for the expected edict of persecution by his writing that he entitled An Encouragement to Martyrs. And it would stand and be called as the document that sets an example before people who were facing persecution and martyrdom, which of course he himself would face very soon before the Roman proconsul, as soon as August 257. You see, he had refused again to sacrifice to pagan deities and firmly professed Christ. Now, the proconsul just initially banned him to a place called Kouribas, a coastal town in what is today called modern Tunisia. It's actually called Korba today. But still, even from there, to the best of his ability, he continued to try and comfort his flock and indeed some other clergy who were also sent to that place. It was in fact during that time that he wrote that he believed he had a vision in which he saw his approaching fate and martyrdom. However, a year passed, during which time he was practically, to all intents and purposes, kept a prisoner in his own villa. But even in that year, a new and more stringent imperial edict was issued, which demanded the execution of all Christian clerics. On the 13th of September 258, Cyprian was imprisoned on the orders of the new proconsul, Galerius Maximus. Thereafter, the public examination of Cyprian by the proconsul was enacted on the 14th of September 258, and interestingly, it has been preserved for all to see. It reads exactly this in this way. Galerius Maximus, are you Thecaeus Cyprianus? Cyprian, I am. Galerius, the most sacred emperor has commanded you to conform to the Roman rites. What do you say? Cyprian, I refuse. Galerius, take heed for yourself. In other words, do you want to take a minute and think about what you've said? Cyprian, do as you bid. In so clear a cause, I may not take heed. Galerius then briefly conferred with his judicial council and then pronounced the following statement that Eusebius, the church historian, documented for us. He said this, you have long lived an irreligious life and have drawn together a number of men bound by unlawful association and professed yourself as an open enemy to the gods and the religion of Rome. And the pious, the most sacred and august emperors have endeavoured in vain to bring you back to conformity with their religious observances. Whereas, therefore, you have been apprehended as a principal and a ringleader in these infamous crime. You shall be made an example to those whom you have wickedly associated with your authority of law, and it shall be ratified in your blood. He then read the sentence to the court from a written tablet, and he said this, it is this the sentence of this court, that Thecaeus Cyprianus be executed by the sword. Cyprian's reply to that was, thanks be to God. The execution was indeed carried out in an open space near the city. A vast crowd was said to have followed Cyprian on his last journey there. He was said to have removed his outer garments, knelt and prayed. He then blindfolded himself, bent over and was beheaded by the sword. The body was taken and interred by Christians near the place of execution. Cyprian's martyrdom was in fact followed by the martyrdom of 8 other of his disciples who had also come from Carthage. It's interesting to note within a few hundred years churches were erected over his tomb and the place of his death, and in later cemetery the graves of such martyrs like him soon became the centres of new urban Christian communities. Okay, that's his life and his death. Let's try and sum this up and reach some conclusions. Cyprian's influence was immense, especially on the Western Church. In many ways, he helped to start to make the Catholic Church the authoritarian church of the bishops rather than the charismatic church of the martyrs, which is quite ironic, isn't it, considering his end? His views on rebaptism were rejected by the 4th century Catholic Church, even in his own Africa in the end. But there was a breakaway Donatist church, which saw itself as the church of the martyrs, which maintained Cyprian's theological position anyway, even on rebaptism, and it continued even after his death. Whilst one might say that Cyprian succeeded in his attempt to magnify the official office of the bishop and of the Church of Rome over the laity and lower local clergy, he was less successful with his view on the independence of all the bishops. In due course, Cyprian's view of a college of equal bishops was overtaken by the Roman Catholic idea of the Pope as the Bishop of Bishops, at least in the West anyway. It is on the nature and unity of the Church that Cyprian's influence has been greatest. His doctrines remain fairly normative for almost 1,000 years, and some of it is only recently that some of his teachings have been relaxed in the Roman Catholic Church. Cyprian of Carthage was a towering figure in early Christianity, and he's revered by many, particularly for his staunch defence of Christian principles and his unwavering commitment to the Church amidst the most challenging of times. However, although Cyprian's life and teachings can offer us valuable insights, they also raise some real points of contention for Christian believers to this day. Firstly, Cyprian's emphasis on the authority of the church hierarchy and his strong advocacy for episcopal authority can be seen as problematic by many Christians today. Many non-Catholic Christians would typically prioritize the authority of Scripture and teach about a doctrine of a priesthood of all believers above all else, viewing the institutional church as always in fact fallible and needing to be subject to continual examination and reform. Cyprian's view on ecclesiastical structure and authority, as seen by many today, is seen as overly hierarchical and potentially, of course, prone to abuses of power. If the top of the pyramid becomes corrupt, it's much more likely, if it holds that type of authority, to affect others. Additionally, Cyprian's approach to the sacraments, particularly his view on baptismal regeneration and the efficacy of the sacraments in confirming grace in and of themselves, completely diverge from those who hold a Reformed or Protestant theology. While Cyprian's sacramental theology still aligns closely with Catholic traditions, Reformed Christians, Protestants, and many Pentecostal Christians would tend to emphasize salvation by grace alone, through faith in Christ alone. Sacrifices, while are simply viewed as symbolic acts, representing the act of grace that has been conferred upon the person, rather than the vehicles of grace in and of themselves. However, despite these theological differences, we can't deny Cyprian's commitment to the unity and purity of the Church and his pastoral care for his flock during really difficult times. His steadfastness in the face of persecutions are qualities that surely must command respect and admiration across all denominational lines and viewpoints. His writings continue to be studied to this day and appreciated for their important theological insights and the historical context in which they lived. But I believe, of course, today we must always approach them with a critical eye, whether from a Christian theological perspective or an historical one. So in conclusion, while many may have theological disagreements with certain aspects of Cyprian's teaching, his life and legacy serve as a reminder of both the individual Christian and the Church's fidelity to Christ and the gospel message, even in the midst of doctrinal differences and persecution like those Cyprian faced. Cyprian's example still challenges many to pursue unity in the essentials of what it means to be a Christian or to be a Christian community. Charity in the non-essential things, and humility in all the other things. And that principle is still recognized and applied by many today who would say they seek to faithfully follow Christ within their own societal contexts, even today. Okay, that's it, friends. Thank you for joining me. Don't forget to subscribe, and that way you'll get a notification as every podcast new episode is dropped. You can do that. You can click and subscribe wherever it is you get your podcasts from. It's in all the made ones like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, all those places, even Audible, I believe. But you can subscribe to it wherever you get it. And that way, you shouldn't miss another single episode. You can also follow the link and support me on the Patreon community. And that way, hopefully, enable me to ensure that this podcast episode remains free and is freely available. And it's there you'll find hours and hours and hours of bonus and exclusive content. At the same time, supporting this podcast and my other podcast projects. So thanks for being with me today, and I do trust I'll see you back here again very soon. Bye-bye for now.